Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now going to cover 2 Samuel chapter 6. We're going to entitle this chapter, The Ark is Brought from Kiriath-Jearim to Jerusalem. In our previous chapter, we see David anointed as king of Israel. That's our context. This is when the elders of Israel came down to David at Hebron because their king Ishbosheth had been killed by Baana and Rechab. And then after that, David did a couple of raids or battles against the Philistines in the Valley of Rephaim, won both of them. He's starting to establish his kingdom now. Then he hired King Hiram of Tyre to build David a cedar palace, which Hiram did. And so David's kingdom is being established. Also in the last chapter, David managed to drive the Jebusites out of Jerusalem, and so David had taken over Jerusalem. So now I'm going to assume he's at Jerusalem as we start in 2 Samuel chapter 6, verses 1 and 2. Now David again gathered all the chosen men of Israel, 30,000, and David arose and went with all the people with him to Baal-Judah, to bring up from there the Ark of God, which is called by the name. And Baal-Judah is another name for Kiriath-Jearim, the very name of the Lord of hosts who is enthroned above the cherubim. Now David gathered all the chosen men of Israel with the advice of his officers, as we find out by looking at the parallel passage in 1 Chronicles 13:1. Then David consulted with the captains of the thousands and the hundreds, even with every leader. So David didn't go off half-cocked. It doesn't say he inquired of the Lord like he always did, interestingly enough. I don't know if we can make anything out of that or not. Maybe he did and it wasn't recorded, but he didn't. It's not stated that he did. So they go to Baal-Judah. As I said, that's Kiriath-Jearim. Now let's look at a map and see where that is. If you look at Jerusalem and you go just about 7 or 8 miles northwest, you're at Kiriath-Jearim. If you go from Bethlehem about 9 or 10 miles northwest, you're at Kiriath-Jearim. So that's where we are, to the west. That's where the Ark is now. Now, I know you're going to think, well, what's the Ark doing at Kiriath-Jearim? Well, I'm going to give you a itinerary of the Ark of the Covenant. Joshua brought it over when he led the people of Israel over the River Jordan, and he camped at Gilgal, where the Ark started out. Then the Ark went to Shiloh, which was to the northeast, in the north there, in Ephraim. Then Eli lost it when his two worthless sons, Hophni and Phinehas, managed to battle the Philistines at Aphek, which is a good bit, about 20 miles or so to the west at Aphek, later called Ebenezer. And so the Philistines took it. The reason it was at Aphek is because Hophni and Phinehas had put the Ark in front of the army, thinking that superstitiously that Ark would let them win, but it didn't. So now the Philistines have got it. They took it from Aphek and Ebenezer, and they took it down to the coast, south and west to the coast at their city of Ashdod. After some boils and hemorrhoids broke out, they didn't like what the Ark was doing, so they took the Ark further south to Gath. I can't remember what happened at Gath off the top of my head, but anyway, they took the Ark from Gath north, back up north to Ekron. These, of course, are three of their major five cities. And in Ekron, they were still having problems with mice in the field and hemorrhoids and such. So they said, that's it. And they went to the Valley of Sorek, Samson's old stomping grounds. They went to a place to the southeast called Beth Shemesh. The people of Beth Shemesh, unfortunately, looked inside the Ark, and some of them died. And they said, oh, we don't want this. So then they go northeast for another 5 or 6 miles and end up at Kiriath-Jearim, which is where we are now. This last stage of the itinerary is talked about in 1 Samuel 7:1. And the men of Kiriath-Jearim came and took the Ark of the Lord and brought it into the house of Abinadab on the hill and concentrated Eleazar his son to keep the Ark of the Lord. So it's been sitting there up at Kiriath-Jearim since the time of the Judges. Remember, the Judges is first part of 11th century B.C. and the time of Saul and David's at the end of the 11th century B.C. So we're talking about a good long time that the Ark has been sitting at Kiriath-Jearim. Gill and Jameson Foster and Brown calculate about 50 years. The Ark's been sitting there. It sat there the whole time, except for one time it ended up at Gibeah of Saul, which is right north of Jerusalem, not too far from maybe 5 or 6 miles to the east of Kiriath-Jearim. 1 Samuel 14:18, then Saul said to Ahijah, bring the Ark of God here, for the Ark of God was at that time with the sons of Israel. But except for that, it stayed at Kiriath-Jearim. Now in verse 2, we read this. to bring up from there the ark of God, which is called by the name. Now that's either the ark, which is called by the name, or that's either God, which is called by the name. It's a little bit ambiguous. John Gill says it's God who is called by the name. In other words, God who is called by the name of Yahweh. He says, quote, not the ark, but the Lord, whose is the ark. His name is called by the name of Jehovah Yahweh, the infinite, incomprehensible, eternal, and immutable being. Adam Clark says, no, it's the ark. The ark is called the ark of Yahweh. I think Clark makes more sense than to bring up from there the ark, which is called by the name, the ark of the covenant, the ark of Yahweh. Doesn't matter really too much either way. The point is, the very name of the Lord of hosts, who is enthroned above the cherubim, gets honor. The cherubim, of course, are the two angelic acacia wood carvings covered with gold that are at the ends of the Ark of the Mercy Seat, which is on top of the Ark of the Covenant. And God, that was his throne between those two cherubim on that Mercy Seat. Mercy Seat was the throne. And of course, he resided there in the form of the Shekinah glory in the Holy of Holies. David takes 30,000 troops to get the Ark, which is a whole heap of troops. Septuagint actually has 70,000, but we'll take 30,000. Why did he take so many? Jameson Fawcett Brown say that David needed a lot of troops lest the undertaking be opposed by the Philistines. He is going west toward Philistine territory. Jameson Fawcett Brown also say that David needed to protect the great numbers of people who are going to be involved in this festive procession bringing the ark back to Jerusalem. We go now to 2 Samuel 6, verses 3 through 5. They placed the ark of God on a new cart that they might bring it from the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill. The they is David and all the people, is the previous subject in verse 2. So all the people placed the ark of God on a new cart that they might bring it from the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill. That's at Kiriath-Jearim. And Uzzah and Ahio, the sons of Abinadab, were leading the new cart. So they brought it with the ark of God from the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill, and Ahio was walking ahead of the ark. Meanwhile, David and all the house of Israel were celebrating before the Lord with all kinds of instruments made of fir wood, and with lyres, harps, tambourines, castanets, and cymbals. Now, why was it a new cart? Well, that was in order to give respect and honor as opposed to an old cart. But it doesn't really matter whether the cart was new or old. It was supposed to be carried on poles according to the Levitical law. They didn't do the carrying legal and proper. Now, let's look at how it was supposed to be done. Let's look at Numbers 4 and 15. Chapter 4, verse 15. When Aaron and his sons have finished covering the holy objects and all the furnishings of the sanctuary, when the camp is to set out, after that the sons of Kohath shall come to carry them, so that they will not touch the holy objects and die. These are the things in the tent of meeting which the sons of Kohath are to carry. Now the Levites were divided into tribes, or I should say the tribe of Levi were divided into families. There was the Kohathites, the Merarites, and the Gershonites. The Kohathites were the ones who were supposed to carry the temple tabernacle furniture, and so the rules applied to the Kohathites. Now, they weren't supposed to touch any of that furniture. Aaron, that's the priest, that was the other family, the family of Aaron. They were the high priest. They were the family of the priest. They had to go in there and cover up the golden altar, the table of showbread, and the Ark of the Covenant, and the seven-branch candlestick. And, of course, they could touch those things as they covered them up. They had to. They wouldn't be able to get them out of there. But the Kohathites could not touch them, because it says in Numbers 4:15, the priests wrap up the furniture so that they, the Kohathites, will not touch the holy objects and die. So that was the rule. You don't touch the holy objects and die. And then they were also told to put poles through the rings on the side of the ark and carry it that way. So this was completely illegal. We don't even know if Uzzah and Ahio were Levites. And they certainly didn't carry the ark on a pole. They put it on a cart. So they were violating God's law. So they're walking along, Ahio in front, leading the ark, probably because the ark was being pulled by some kind of an oxen or something. And meanwhile, behind the ark, we got David and lots of people from Jerusalem dancing, carrying on, praising God with all kinds of instruments, lyres, harps, tambourines, castanets, and cymbals, and everything's fine and dandy. I said that Uzzah and Ahio weren't Levites. Jameson Fawcett Brown actually says they were, but there's no evidence that they actually were. And we have to ask ourselves, why would so many people there that were versed in the law allow this illegal method of carrying the ark to be carried out? David knew the law. There were priests there. There were Levites there. Well, perhaps they were just following this example of the Philistines. The Philistines had carried the ark on a cart as they went from Ashdod to Gath to Ekron to Beth Shemesh. Nobody died then. Well, the Philistines were ignorant pagans, and they weren't held to the same standard as the Israelites were held to, the Israelites who had the law, as John Gill says. So that's probably the difference right there, is you're talking about to whom much has been given, much is required. But at any rate, Uzzah and Ahio compromised with their pagan culture and carried the arks the way the pagans did it. Now, Uzzah may have become too familiar with the ark. He had grown up in his father, Abinadab, the high priest, had grown up in that household with the ark, and maybe he just didn't think it was any big deal to put it on a cart. We're going to find out, of course, in the next couple of verses, Uzzah is going to be struck dead for doing this. Now, Abinadab had been stated earlier to be taking care of the ark at Kiriath-Jearim with his son Eleazar. Eleazar's not here. Other two sons are Uzzah and Ahio. So John Gill speculates that Eleazar is dead. And in fact, Abinadab himself might be dead by now. So now you're not just talking about flunkies leading the ark. You're talking about the two leading priests of the area of Kiriath-Jearim are leading the ark. And they're not doing it right. Well, all this singing and dancing wasn't going to last too long, because as we go to verses 6 and 7, we see that tragedy strikes. But when they, that's the whole company of Israelites, came to the threshing floor of Nacon, that's N-A-C-O-N, Uzzah reached out toward the ark of God and took hold of it, for the oxen nearly upset it. And the anger of the Lord burned against Uzzah, and God struck him down there for his irreverence, and he died there by the ark of God. Nacon is also called Chidon, C-H-I-D-O-N, in 1 Chronicles 13:9, just for information purposes. It's unknown where this threshing floor of Nacon is. Some speculate it's the threshing floor of Araunah the Jebusite, whose threshing floor David bought as a site for the temple later on, and where the Temple Mount is, and where Solomon's temple was built. And later on, of course, the Al-Aqsa Mosque is there now, the Dome of the Rock. But that's just speculation. It's just some place near Jerusalem. We don't need to know where it is, except that it's the place where Uzzah died for touching the ark. Now, this is what Gill says about that death. Quote, "This shows that it is dangerous in matters of worship to act contrary to the command of God, even in things that may seem small and trivial. And though what may be done with a good intention, as this was, yet that will not excuse the sin. Nor are those who are the most forward and zealous in religious matters exempted from marks of God's displeasure when they go wrong." Well, I've already mentioned Numbers 4:15, but let me refer you to it again. "The sons of Kohath shall carry the furniture so that they will not touch the holy objects and die." In other words, Aaron and his sons are going to wrap the holy objects, the furniture in the tabernacle, including the ark, so that the sons of Kohath, the people carrying the ark, would not touch the holy objects and die. And in fact, they're not even supposed to see the holy objects even for a moment in verse 20, Numbers 4, or they will die. But verse 20 says, "But they shall not go in to see the holy objects even for a moment, or they will die." How did Uzzah die? Speculations, maybe struck by lightning, maybe the ark fell on him, I don't think so. Maybe just died by the direct action of God with no outside natural cause. Doesn't matter. He died. Now, this prohibition in Numbers 4, 15 through 20, about not touching the holy objects, so you're going to die. This was the first person that actually did that and died. Now, Nadab and Abihu offered strange fire, profane fire. That's not quite the same thing as touching holy objects. So this is the first one. Now, let's talk about how culpable he was in doing that. Let's look at some mitigating circumstances. First of all, Uzzah sinned through ignorance. He probably didn't know the law. It had been a long time since the tabernacle had been carried by Kohathites. I mean, that was a long time ago. That's probably 100 years or so. 200 years. I mean, we've got to go all the way back through the time of Saul. And then we've got to go through all the time of the judges. Then we've got to go through the time of the Exodus. About 100 years or so, I'd say. So, he didn't know what the law was. If I was his defense attorney trying to defend him, I would also say Hey, Uzzah had no time to reflect. The ark was about to fall on the ground, and it would have been disrespectful for the ark to hit the ground, so he tried to save it from pollution and profanation. I would also add that Uzzah had the best of intentions. As he did that, he didn't want the ark to fall on the ground and be broken on the ground. And besides, Uzzah had seen Philistines touching the ark, and they hadn't died. Now, of course, the Philistines were pagans. Their standards were lower, but all these mitigating factors did not weigh enough on God's mind to stop God's execution of Uzzah. Now, so we need to look at why the punishment of death had to be inflicted on Uzzah. First of all, if Uzzah had not been struck dead, the populace may have lost respect and awe of God's holiness. I'm sure they had a lot of awe when they saw this. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say, quote, "It is apparent that the divine purpose was to inspire awe of his majesty, a submission to his law, and a profound veneration for the symbols and ordinances of his worship." Also, we might notice that this was a religious procession that was being carried out by David. A lot of singing, a lot of praying, a lot of praising to God. It would sure be a bad example to treat the ark profanely in front of all those people who were looking for religious leadership. Adam Clark says that Uzzah committed a sin unto death, but doubtless the mercy of God was extended to his soul. And I think that we don't look at death the way God does. If Uzzah had his heart in the right place and he died, well, his soul went straight to be with Jesus. He didn't care that he wasn't there to have to put up with the Philistines. Well, that joyous procession was certainly halted. The ark was left to near where it was in the near vicinity of Jerusalem at the threshing floor of Nacon. So while it's there, let's look at some different punishments that occurred because the ark was profaned. The Philistines, they weren't killed, but they had diseases like boils and hemorrhoids and mice running through their field. We talked about that in previous chapters. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say that these boils and hemorrhoids were relieved by oblations to God. I don't remember that actually happening, but that's what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say. But at any rate, the Philistines weren't killed. The people of Beth Shemesh, the first Israelite town that received the ark back from the Philistines, now they did die. God struck down the men of Beth Shemesh because they looked inside the ark of the Lord. Ooh, wanted to look at God, wanted to look at the Shekinah glory. God struck down 70 men out of 50,000. The people mourned because the Lord struck them with a great slaughter. So basically you see here the pattern. The Israelites, they've been given much, but to them is much required. The Philistines just had a little bit of disease and pestilence, mice running through their fields. But boy, the Israelites got killed when they violated the holiness of God. So we go to 2 Samuel 6, verse 8. David became angry because of the Lord's outburst against Uzzah, and that place is called Perez Uzzah to this day. The threshing floor of Nacon is called Perez Uzzah. Perez means breakthrough, and Uzzah, of course, is his name. In other words, it was an outbreak against Uzzah. Perez means outbreak or out through, so it's an outbreak against Uzzah. Now, David was angry because of this. Why was he angry? Who was he angry with? Well, he could have been angry with God. He could say, well, God, you know, it was just a small offense. He was trying to right the ark. He wasn't trying to do anything bad. He had good intentions, and you killed him? You've just ruined my joyful procession in Jerusalem. And look at what my enemies are going to think. They're going to think this is an ill omen. This is a superstitious age. Oh, David, the king, is trying to bring the ark back in Jerusalem, and the first thing that happens is somebody struck dead for touching it? That's not going to make David look good. So, yeah, he's angry. Could have been he was angry not at God, but at Uzzah. He could have been angry that Uzzah had not been more responsible. But I suspect David was just as clueless about how to carry that ark as Uzzah. He would have given some instructions on how to carry it. We go to 2 Samuel 6, verses 9 and 10. So David was afraid of the Lord that day, and he said, "How can the ark of the Lord come to me?" And David was unwilling to move the ark of the Lord into the city of David with him. But David took it aside to the house of Obed-Edom the Gittite. Now, David was afraid of the Lord. He was probably afraid that he could be killed for some infraction he was unaware of. Or if he was not going to be killed, some of the people of Jerusalem could be killed. Now, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown make the point that David did not consult the Urim and Thummim like he usually did. In a previous audio, I went through a lot of scriptures, about five or so, where David consulted the Urim and Thummim before he did anything. He didn't do it here. All he had to do was say, God, should I continue on with this and bring the ark into Jerusalem? White stone, yes. Black stone, no. Or whatever the Urim and Thummim was. But he didn't do it. So he was afraid, and his fear might have been aggravated by his resentment towards the Lord, if indeed he was angry at the Lord in the previous verse, and I suspect he was. How can the Ark of the Lord come to me? David asked. He's not worrying about whether there were Levites or not to carry it, because Levites afterwards did carry it. He was doubting now whether it was the will of God for the Ark to even be in Jerusalem. Maybe David's thinking, maybe I should have left it in Gibeon. So David took the Ark aside to the house of Obed-Edom the Gittite, aside from the threshing floor of Nacon, left it with a house of somebody must have known this guy. A Gittite means somebody from Gath, the Philistine city Gath. At least that's what some people think. It could be a place called Gath-Rimmon, which is a Levitical city mentioned in Joshua 21:24. Ajalon with its pasture lands, Gath-Rimmon with its pasture lands. Sounds like it's near Ajalon, which is, of course, the famous place where Joshua made the sun and the moon stand still. So anyway, wherever it is, Obed-Edom lived there. Now, this Obed-Edom was a Levite. That's probably why David left it there with a Levite. I mean, you could say that Obed-Edom the Gittite is a foreigner because Gittite is somebody that lives in Gath, and that's where Philistines live. But no, Obed-Edom was a Levite. We learned that from 1 Chronicles 15:16. Then David spoke to the chiefs of the Levites to appoint their relatives the singers with instruments of music, harps, lyres, loud-sounding cymbals to raise sounds of joy. So we know that Levites were singers, and then two verses later in 1 Chronicles 15:18, and with them their relatives of the second rank, Zechariah, Ben, Jezael, Shemiramoth, Jehiel, Uni, Eliab, Benaiah, Messiah, Mattathiah, Eliphelehu, Migneah, Obed-Edom. So he's listed in a list of singers. Obed-Edom and Jael, the gatekeepers. So they were gatekeepers and singers. So he was a Levite. It makes sense for David to leave the ark with a Levite. We go to 2 Samuel 6, verses 11 through 12. Thus the ark of the Lord remained in the house of Obed-Edom the Gittite 3 months. And the Lord blessed Obed-Edom and all his household. Nobody died. In fact, I don't know whether he was blessed because nobody died and he just survived, or whether because good things happened to him. It doesn't say. Now it was told King David, saying, the Lord has blessed the house of Obed-Edom and all that belongs to him on account of the ark of God. David went and brought up the ark of God from the house of Obed-Edom into the city of David with gladness. The city of David, by the way, is Zion, that ridge that runs south of Mount Ophel on the north, Tyrpanian Valley on the west, the Kidron Valley on the east, the Valley of Hinnom on the southern tip, Mount Ophel on the northern tip, where the Millo was as a fortress. That's the city of David. Now, these blessings that were told to David, they came quickly, within 3 months, because that's as long as Obed-Edom had the ark there, which means that the blessings could not be accounted for naturally. They happened so quickly, some people speculate. But whatever these blessings were, whether it was just the fact that nobody was killed, at any rate, David saw these blessings and said, I'm not afraid to bring the ark into Jerusalem anymore. I mean, it's ironic that this ark that killed people was the same ark that brought blessing. It's kind of like the law of God in the Old Testament. It'll kill you, but at the same time, it'll bring you blessing if you obey its precepts. Now, it says in verse 12 that David went and brought up to Jerusalem, Jerusalem's high, went up and brought up the ark of God from the house of Obed-Edom into the city of David. Now, it just says he did that with gladness in verse 12. But the Septuagint adds to that and says this, and he had 7 choirs carrying the ark, a sacrifice, a calf, and lambs. And David played on harmonious organs before the Lord. And David was clothed with a costly tunic. And David and all the house of Israel brought the ark of the Lord with rejoicing and the sound of a trumpet. Well, that's just a little bit more colorful, a little bit more descriptive. Of course, I don't know if it's in the original text or not, but it's in the Septuagint translation. It's not found. Adam Clark says it's not found in any manuscript, nor in the Chaldee, the Syriac, nor the Arabic, nor in any parallel place, nor in the parallel place in 1 Chronicles 15:25. So, I don't know how valid that Septuagint translation is, but at any rate, it does say they brought up the ark with gladness. It's a happy time. We go to 2 Samuel 6, verses 13 through 15. When those carrying the ark of the Lord advanced 6 steps, he, that's David, sacrificed an ox and a fattened calf. David was dancing with all his might before the Lord, wearing a linen ephod. He and the whole house of Israel were bringing up the ark of the Lord with shouts and the sound of the ram's horn. Now, those carrying the ark, they were carrying it right this time, I can guarantee you. And in fact, we read in parallel passage in 1 Chronicles 15:2, David said, no one is to carry the ark of God, but the Levites. He made clear, only the Levites, for the Lord chose them to carry the ark of God and to minister to him forever. And I can assume that the Levites used the staves and the rings properly to carry the ark like they were supposed to. They had only gone 6 steps when they stopped and had a sacrifice of an ox and a fattened calf. 6 steps. Maybe the Israelites were so happy that they had managed to move without anybody dying. They said, "Whoo, we made it 6 steps. Let's stop and have a sacrifice." Now, 1 Chronicles 15:26, the parallel passage says it was more than an ox and a fattened calf that were sacrificed. Let me read that. Because God was helping the Levites who were carrying the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, they sacrificed 7 bulls and 7 rams. Well, how do you reconcile that? Well, the 7 bulls and 7 rams were in total. That's the total number of sacrifices they did going from the house of Obed-Edom, the Gittite, all the way into Jerusalem. They would stop and have a sacrifice and go a little bit further, stop and have a sacrifice. This ox and fattened calf that we read about in verse 13 of our chapter here, 2 Samuel 5, is just the first sacrifice. There were more. Now, verse 14 says that David was dancing with all his might. Here's what Jameson Fawcett Brown says about that. Quote, "intimating violent efforts of leaping and divested of his royal mantle in a state of undress, conduct apparently unsuitable to the gravity of age or the dignity of a king. But it was unquestionably done as an act of religious homage, his attitudes and dress being symbolic, as they have always been in Oriental countries, of penitence, joy, thankfulness, and devotion, symbolic of those things." David was also wearing an ephod. Now, of course, an ephod is a breastplate, kind of like a vest. Other people, usually the high priest was the only person that wore an ephod in the law. But then priests started wearing ephods. You see it more and more. Abiathar, the high priest that came from Nob and went with David out to Achish of Gath, if you recall that story. Abiathar had an ephod. David here has an ephod. John Gill says it's more congruent with the service of God for David to wear an ephod than to be wearing royal robes. He's in a priestly function now. He's not a priest, but he's in a religious type situation now rather than a kingly type. The NIV Study Bible says, quote, "David perhaps signaled his desire to lead the people of God in worship, and he took off his royal robes to wear that ephod to make it easier to dance," John Gill says. Well, I'm sure that's true. Hard to dance in robes, especially kingly robes. We go now to 2 Samuel 6, verse 16. "Then it happened as the ark of the Lord came into the city of David that Michal, the daughter of Saul, looked out of the window," and of course that's David's wife, "looked out of the window and saw King David leaping and dancing before the Lord, and she despised him in her heart." John Gill says of Michal, "apparently she had a good deal of her father's haughty temper and disposition." Remember, her father Saul was a real SOB. He was a murderer. He was a terrible guy. And apparently, like father, like daughter, she was upset because she thought David was not acting according to his royal dignity. But she kept a displeasure to herself. It says in verse 16, she despised him, despised David in her heart, quietly. I wonder how the writer of 2 Samuel found out about it. I suppose the word got out eventually. Doesn't surprise me in a court. People are going to say, she was really upset with King David. We go to 2 Samuel 6, verses 17 through 19. "So they brought in the ark of the Lord and set it in its place inside the tent which David had pitched for it. And David offered burnt offerings and peace offerings before the Lord. When David had finished offering the burnt offering and the peace offering, he blessed the people in the name of the Lord of hosts. Further, he distributed to all the people, to all the multitude of Israel, both to men and women, a cake of bread and one of dates and one of raisins to each one. Then all the people departed, each to his house." Now, this tent that David built for the ark was not the tabernacle of Moses. That was at Gibeon. We know that by going to 1 Chronicles, 1 Chronicles 16:39, and Zadok the priest and his brethren the priest before the tabernacle of the Lord in the high place that was at Gibeon, 1 Chronicles 21:29. "For the tabernacle of the Lord, which Moses made in the wilderness, and the altar of the burnt offering were at that season in the high place at Gibeon." 2 Chronicles 1:3, "So Solomon and all the congregation with him went to the high place that was at Gibeon, for there was the tabernacle of the congregation of God." So let's trace, I've already traced for you the ark. Let's trace the tabernacle. Of course, the ark and the tabernacle were together. When Joshua brought the Israelites to Gilgal, they camped there. Then they took the ark and the covenant up to Shiloh. They were together. And then the ark got stolen at the Battle of Aphek, which was a little bit west of Shiloh. And the ark is now separated from the tabernacle. The tabernacle presumably was still at Shiloh, And then the next time we see the tabernacle was at Nob, when David fled from Jerusalem to Nob, which is right north of the Mount of Olives. And then after that, the tabernacle was taken to Gibeon. Now, David just built a tent for the tabernacle. He didn't move the tabernacle of Moses from Gibeon to Jerusalem. Let's continue on. Once it was in Gibeon, it stayed there until Solomon built the temple after David was dead. And then Solomon brought the tabernacle from Gibeon and stored it in the temple somewhere, maybe in one of the storerooms. And then the tabernacle disappears from history. Now, we ask the question, why didn't David move the tabernacle of Moses from Gibeon to Jerusalem? Here's one speculation, probably because the tabernacle was too large for the temporary place David had chosen for the ark. I don't really think that's the reason. I think the commentator Benson and others have said that David had contemplated the building of a temple and he didn't have need for the tabernacle. The tabernacle's a tent. He was going to build an acacia wood temple, gold stone temple. Didn't need a temporary tent or tabernacle. I think that makes sense. But we need to remember the ark is now in a tent. It's not in the tabernacle of Moses. Now in verse 17, we see that David offered burnt offerings and peace offerings before the Lord, before that ark. But David's not a priest. How can he be offering burnt offerings and peace offerings when he's not a priest? Well, the NIV Study Bible says it's because David did it by the priests who were with him. We go to 1 Chronicles 15:11. And David called for Zadok and Abiathar, the priest, and for the Levites, for Uriel, Asaiah, and Joel, Shemaiah, and Eliel, and Aminadab. But those were the Levites. But he also called for Zadok and Abiathar, the priest. So they were the ones who offered those sacrifices. John Gill says this must be supposed to be done by a priest and not by David himself, who was no priest. Now in verse 18, it says, David blessed the people in the name of the Lord of hosts, in the name of the Yahweh of hosts. How could David bless the people? He's not a priest. Well, he didn't bless the people as a priest. He blessed the people as a prince. Adam Clark says here, quote, David acted here as priest, for it was the general prerogative of the priest to bless the people. But it appears by both David and Solomon that it was the prerogative of the kings also. Jameson Fawcett and Brown say the blessing was done by David, quote, in the double character of prophet and king. Not priest, but prophet and king. Well, however he did it, he did it. He blessed the people. That would be the 30,000 men who went with him to get the ark, plus all the women who received the presents of cakes from David. That's a lot of people. 30,000 men who went to get the ark are mentioned in 2 Samuel 6:1, the first verse of this chapter. It states specifically that there were 30,000 men to go get the ark. So David gave quite a lot away, but that probably gave him a whole lot of goodwill at the beginning of his kingdom. That food he gave away makes my mouth water now. Bread, dates, raisins, really sounds good. We go to verse 20, 2 Samuel 6. But when David returned to bless his household, Michal, the daughter of Saul, came out to meet David and said, "How the king of Israel distinguished himself today. He uncovered himself today in the eyes of his servants' maids as one of the foolish ones shamelessly uncovers himself." This is, of course, total sarcasm. How he's distinguished himself today. So isn't that great? David goes home to bless his household. He's got about 8 wives, and one of them is Michal. And instead of getting thanks for that blessing, he gets shamed by his wife, one of his wives. How was he planning to bless them, what was his aim? Well, John Gill says to bless them with all happiness, or maybe to pray to God for them to be blessed temporally and spiritually. But he came to bless, and instead he got chewed out. Now, it was the custom of patriarchs to bless their own families because they were priests in their families. In fact, Stephen called David a patriarch in Acts 2, verse 29. "Brethren, I may confidently say to you regarding the patriarch David, that he both died and was buried, and his tomb is with us to this day." Now, Michal says, "Hey, David, you uncovered yourself the days in the eyes of your servants made." The Holman Christian Study Bible translates it this way. The king, he, David, exposed himself today in the sight of the slave girls. Sounds like he was flashing the slave girls, like he was committing a sexual offense. No, that's not what it means. It means he took his royal robes off and started dancing. That's all it means. And he wore an ephod, and an ephod certainly isn't immodest. It says he wore an ephod. How are you going to wear an ephod when you're naked? That's just foolishness. Adam Clark says, quote, "It was probable that David used some violent gesticulations by means of which some parts of his body became uncovered. but it is very probable that we cannot guess all that was implied in this reproach. Well, Clark sort of plays with the idea that David was naked, or partially naked, as he danced around. I don't think so. I think that we can rest assured that what Michael was upset about was that she felt David had not behaved in a dignified way suitable for a king. Jameson Fawcett Brown says, quote, she was, quote, proud of her royal extraction. She upbraided her husband for lowering the dignity of the crown and acting more like a buffoon than a king. Well, David's not going to put up with this nonsense. We read in verses 21 through 23 as we finish this chapter. So David said to Michael, it was before the Lord who chose me above your father and above all his house to appoint me ruler over the people of the Lord, over Israel. Therefore I will celebrate before the Lord. I will be more lightly esteemed than this and will be humble in my own eyes, but with the maids of whom you have spoken, with them I will be distinguished. And then verse 23, Michal, the daughter of Saul, had no child to the day of her death. Well, David's rebuke was extremely sharp. Michal now could really have no doubt that she's really stepped in it with her husband. One can only speculate what their marriage was after that. It's probably not, he had eight wives. Michal had competition. I bet Michal was at low of the bottom end of the pecking order after this. Now, this is ironic because David went to a lot of trouble to get Michal back. Remember, Saul had taken Michal away from David and he had lost her. But then after Saul was dead and David was trying to set up his kingdom with against Ishbosheth, David's in Hebron, Ishbosheth is Mahanaim, about halfway up the Dead Sea on the east at the river Jabbok. And then David had made it a prerequisite to get Michal back, a prerequisite for the reunion of the northern and southern kingdoms. This would show that the house of Saul and the house of David are happily reunited together, and he needed to get her back. Maybe it was for political reasons, maybe not personal. But at any rate, he's ticked off now. And he says, hey, it was before the Lord I was dancing, and the Lord Yahweh chose me above your father. In other words, your dad is dead and gone because he sinned against God, and Samuel prophesied over me that I was going to be king. Ho, ho, ho. So this was a humiliating put-down that David put over Michal. Michal really didn't understand the depth of David's love for God that would cause him to dance like that and lower his dignity. He says, look, I'm dancing before the Lord. It was before the Lord, before the Lord, before the ark of the Lord. In other words, right in front of God, because he looked at the ark as the place where God lived. Now, verse 22 is a little bit strange. I will be more lightly esteemed than this and will be humble in my own eyes. King James says, I will be more vile than this. A great translation. It's a little bit strong. In other words, what he's saying is, I'll make myself look foolish. I'll be humble in my own eyes by dancing around and being rejoicing. I'll be humble before you, he implies. But with the maids of whom you have spoken, with them I will be distinguished. Michal had said, you took your royal robes off in front of the slave girls. And David says, hey, but with those slave girls, they gonna think I'm distinguished. They don't care if I'm dancing because they love Yahweh, which you apparently don't, Michal. I'm, of course, adding some of the conversation here just by speculation and reasonable inference. Those maids were going to honor David even if David's own wife wouldn't. Now, the last verse says, Michal, the daughter of Saul, had no child to the day of her death. Now, the reason that's put in there is obvious, is to show that she was punished because she made fun of her husband. She was not exactly the submissive wife here, the supporting wife, the helpmeet that God had given David. No, she helped him escape one time from Saul, saved his life, but here, no, she wasn't a good wife. Now, of course, having a child was what all Israelite women wanted more than anything, and she didn't have one. Now, that could mean no child, period, all of her life to the day of her death, or it could mean no child from this point on. There's some question about that because of one of the translations in the King James translation in 2 Samuel 21:8 mentions five sons of Michal, the daughter of Saul. The NASB has five sons of Merab, the daughter of Saul, whom she had born to Adriel. King James has whom she raised, brought up for Adriel. So she either could have had taken up five sons for Adriel who died and raised them up as foster kids, or it could be that it's not even Michal that 2 Samuel 21:8 is talking about. It's rather Merab, depends on the translation there, or the text. Or it could be that she didn't have five any more sons. She already had some before by David, but she didn't have any right after that. It really doesn't matter. The point is, she was punished for her effrontery. And I think what it means is she never had any kids, period. I think that's the easiest understanding of this. So she never had a son who could inherit the throne. The seed of Saul and David would never be mixed, as John Gill says. And once more, we see the stomping out of Saul's dynasty as he was foolish enough to try to fight against Yahweh and against Samuel, Yahweh's prophet. We are finished now with 2 Samuel 6. We are ready now to go in our next audio to 2 Samuel 7, verses 1 through 29. We'll look at the Lord's famous covenant with David, the Davidic covenant. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.